It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. There's been widespread reporting on our program and elsewhere about where people can try to access COVID vaccinations. Now a new study by University of Pittsburgh researchers finds that in many parts of our nation, Black people are less likely than whites to live near a facility that administers the vaccine. WESA's health reporter Sarah Bowden has been examining this study and joins us now. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Kevin.
So in urban areas, near means living within 1 mile. Sarah, what did researchers tell you about how they determined their findings?
What they did is they took U.S. Census info and the location of potential vaccination sites, so places like pharmacies and health clinics, and fed everything into a supercomputer. And as a result, they were able to figure out the fastest way for a person to get to a vaccination site.
According to your reporting on this story, the greatest disparities tend to be in cities with large Black populations, including New Orleans, Atlanta, Detroit. What about here in Pennsylvania? Are there any spots where the disparities stand out?
Well, if you look at the map, there actually within urban areas aren't any Black neighborhoods that are more than a mile from a potential vaccination site. But again, we're just talking about potential vaccination sites. So I would be really curious once the vaccine becomes more widely available, which health clinics and pharmacies and which of these sites actually receive vaccinations.
Mm-hmm. The proximity of a vaccination site, is it especially critical because of what you and others have been reporting on for months, the likelihood for Black Americans to contract the virus and experience worse outcomes?
Yeah. So on Monday's All Things Considered, Andy Slavitt, who is a senior advisor to the White House's COVID-19 response team, told Mary Louise Kelly that vaccines need to chase people. We can't expect people to chase vaccines. And what he means by that is that the harder it is for someone to reach a vaccination, the less likely they are to get inoculated. So in areas where there aren't many nearby locations for vaccinations, people in those areas are less likely to get vaccinated. And as the study notes, these areas are more likely home to populations of people who are less likely to own their own vehicles and more likely to rely on public transportation. So the physical barriers are real.
Yeah, more than a mile away. You know, we've been hearing reports from you, colleague Kylie Kaczynski, about people traveling to other counties to get a shot. So how does access to transportation, a car, compound that challenge of not having that drugstore, that community health center near where you live?
It just takes longer to get from point A to point B, and 5 miles might take more than an hour. And of course, public transportation during a pandemic is more dangerous. And then you have to factor in things like childcare, or maybe you have a job where hours aren't very flexible, so you can't take off 3 hours to get a vaccination. So public health agencies and medical systems, they need to figure out ways to make sure the physical locations of vaccination sites are highly accessible. And I do know that Allegheny County Health Department says it's working on this. I also know that some other medical systems are working on this, but I haven't seen, at least here locally, too many plans released yet to address how they can make sure that vaccines are physically in the communities that need them the most.
Access to quality health care has been inequitable for decades or more. So are these findings surprising at all?
The results of this study were alarming, but not surprising. And I do think that white Americans have a tendency to treat racism as sort of an abstraction or a set of bad or embarrassing behaviors. And what this study shows is that racism literally shapes our physical environments in ways that are not equitable and in ways that we can measure.
Mm-hmm. And that physical environment can be the locations of pharmacies, drugstores, community health community centers, etc.
Exactly.
Sarah, you also reported on a separate study by Duquesne University that found higher levels of racial and socioeconomic segregation predicted higher COVID-19 mortality rates. How much higher was the mortality rate in areas that are segregated?
So counties where 10% of their Black population was in racially segregated neighborhoods. For every 10% increase of that, there was an 11% increase in COVID death. And for every 10% increase in socioeconomic segregation in counties, there was a 14% increase in COVID fatalities. And I realize, you know, that's a lot of numbers, but the important thing I want listeners to understand is that, again, we can measure disparity and predict an area's level of risk, which hopefully will influence where resources are deployed.
Sarah Bowden is WESA's health and science reporter. Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pittsburgh Penguins ended their search for a new general manager this week and actually landed two big names in hockey, Ron Hextall as GM and Brian Burke as president of hockey operations. Rob Rossi is senior writer covering hockey and the Penguins for The Athletic. Welcome back, Rob.
Good morning to you, Kevin.
Rob, when we talked shortly after general manager Jim Rutherford abruptly resigned, you did have Ron Hextall as one of the top two contenders for the GM job. So no surprise there?
Not really. It's my understanding from talking to sources that Hextall, Rangers assistant general manager Chris Drury, and current New Jersey Devils general manager Tom Fitzgerald were sort of the three that Penguins were targeting.
And Hextall was Mario Lemieux's favorite, the owner. I mean, the two have a long history. They've known each other for many, many years.
Sources have told me that the only way to view these moves are as Mario moves. And by that, I mean moves that Mario Lemieux had a heavy hand in, which makes a lot of sense. Not only is he one of the majority co-owners, but he's one of the few guys in this world that anybody from hockey would pick up the phone when he calls.
Tuesday's announcement was not just about Hextall. The Pens announced former Toronto and Anaheim GM Brian Burke as head of hockey operations. Was there any indication they were actually looking for someone and actually creating this job?
Well, there was indication as I talked to people around the league and with the team that they were open to a structure that had a president of hockey operations. I had not heard they were looking to do that immediately. That might be something that they thought about based off their interviews with these candidates. It might be something they considered this summer, and that the GM who was hired would have been told they were thinking about that. But Brian Burke, to my knowledge, who is a Lemieux confidant and who Lemieux sought to ask advice on who should be GM candidates early in this process, Brian Burke was called Monday late afternoon, I guess, and said by David Morehouse. And basically the conversation was like, Mario wants me to call you and ask you to come join us.
And of course, David Morehouse, the president and CEO of the Penguins, your colleague Josh Yoey at The Athletic said that Mario tabbed Burke as the missing link. What's he mean by that?
Well, the Penguins have had a structure during the Jim Rutherford 7 years where Rutherford reported to David Morehouse, the CEO. That is not to say David Morehouse was dictating hockey policy, but as CEO of the organization, ownership wanted him to be in the loop and to, you know, be able to share his thoughts about moves, especially big moves. The Penguins are an organization whose brand is built around stars and sort of an aesthetically pleasing brand of hockey. You know, Morehouse has a vested interest in making sure that that brand remains intact.
But he's a business guy.
He is the head of the business operations. Kevin, we have to remember hockey is a sport that generates the, you know, up to 70% of its revenue from gate. And they've not been getting gate since last, really for the Penguins, since last February. So it's reasonable to think that Morehouse's attention is going to be required more on the business side than ever before. And in Brian Burke, you have an experienced hockey executive who can sort of fill the role he was filling in communicating with management and protecting Hextall from some of the things Hextall doesn't like to do, because Ron Hextall is one of those general managers who really likes to do the nitty-gritty nuts and bolts work, Kevin. But really, to just focus on his job.
Okay, what about that dynamic between Ron Hextall and Brian Burke? Burke has a reputation of being maybe a bit aggressive in making moves. Hextall maybe a bit more conservative, more of a builder. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, it is. That doesn't mean that Hextall won't be aggressive. I mean, that was sort of the reputation he had coming out of Philadelphia. By nature of taking the job in Pittsburgh, because you have Crosby and Malkin and ownership wants both of those guys to retire in Pittsburgh, you're going to be in a win-now mode. The Penguins want Ron Hextall to help them by next season become a cup contender again, but also not at the complete expense of the future. Jim Rutherford took win-now mode as to never worry about the future. I mean, these are going to be Ron Hextall's calls, except for when it comes to Sidney Crosby, Evgeny Malkin, and Chris Letang, the latter to the extent of which those are always going to be decisions ownership's heavily involved in because of what those guys have meant to the organization.
Brian Burke has long favored physical hockey, not exactly the Penguins' MO. Do you think there's going to be a makeover of this team eventually?
Yeah, I do, from the standpoint of I don't know that they're going to be content, Burke or Hextall, to want a team that is quite as reliant on speed and skill. The Penguins are always going to prioritize skill and scoring. That's their brand. They're owned by Mario Lemieux, who is the most skilled player in the history of the sport. Nobody disputes that. They have banners at the arena celebrating Stanley Cup championships and scoring championships won by Lemieux, Jagr, Crosby, and Malkin. That's all you need to know. But they are a team that, under Jim Rutherford, favored sort of smaller forwards that could win with speed and win puck races. They don't want to be a plodding or a slow team, but if you look at the team Hextall built, they're not as fast, but they are deep and they are skilled. If you look at the teams that Burke has tried to build in the years, his best teams have been skilled, but had more of a size component. So I think you're going to see a mix of that. And I think it helps that that might also protect the Stars here in a way that they're not being protected now. Mm-hmm. But look, they're still going to be the Penguins. They just, the Penguins will evolve in a way that the league is going with, but they're not going to change their primary DNA.
Rob Rossi is a senior writer for The Athletic, covering the Penguins and hockey. Rob, thanks as always.
My pleasure, Kevin. Good to hear from you. Stay safe.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Mark Cherna will retire from leading Allegheny County's Department of Human Services next month. He's overseen seismic changes since joining the department in 1997. He tells 90.5 WESA's Kate Chiamarisi that when he arrived, Allegheny County's Child Welfare Agency was in disarray. It had a 40% turnover rate, huge caseloads for social workers, a massive adoption backlog, and deep financial problems. Cherna also says the community despised it for its lack of services and poor quality of care.
So, you know, the one thing I knew is that there's only one place to go but up and coming in here. It was so bad. And what I did when I first came in is I went out to the community almost nonstop and asked folks, you know, what did you think was wrong and what do you think we can do to fix it? And, you know, not tell them what I thought we should do, but ask from the people who are affected by this and go anywhere people would invite me. So I was going everywhere, you know, almost seven nights a week and speaking to everybody. I went and talked to all my staff directly and asked them what they thought was going on. How can we help around this thing? And a very important thing was partnering with Max Baer, who now Supreme Court Justice, who was the administrative judge at the time. And we really partnered because the courts are such an important system. They really control when children are placed and if children go home and all that. So to start partnering on trying to get the caseloads under control, closing cases that have been open for, quote, monitoring, but we never saw them because caseloads were so high. So if a family is fairly stable, we would close it. And they may come back later, but in the meantime, you can concentrate on who really needed interventions. We also look to start expediting the adoptions and get kids out the back door. So Max and I went to Reed Smith, and who was the largest law firm in town at the time, and asked Dan Booker if they would do some pro bono adoptions for us. And not only did he agree to do that, but he agreed to take on, you know, almost a whole piece of it. And, you know, sort of great public-private partnership around that. And that gave a message to other folks that if Fried Smith is willing to work with us, then, you know, maybe they can too. So one of the other things we did right away is put a director's action line in place, a complaint line, which gave people a vehicle to call when they had complaints, when their visits didn't happen, when they couldn't get their caseworker on the phone, and then have, you know, seasoned caseworkers who are not part of a system to give them like a second opinion and make sure things got done.
If you had to only name one thing that you are the most proud of, or you sort of see as the measure of your success over the years, what would that one thing be?
You know, one of the key things is that we need to be part of a community. We work for the community. We work for the taxpayers. So they have a right to demand excellence. They have a right to demand customer service and from the best quality you can, and to be treated respectfully and all the rest of it. So I think, you know, one of the things I'm most proud of is that we have that, for the most part, people feel like they are getting good service and they are being treated right, and that it's a government that works. And that does not help. That doesn't happen much around the country. Another very important part that I'm very proud of is that we are very much driven by the people we serve in the community. We have tons of community engagement. People are represented in our meetings. They most, you know, often outnumber the professionals, you know, paid professionals. And that really drives a lot of what we do in terms of the values.
So one thing that I know you and I have talked a lot about in recent years and that your department has become, you know, nationally known for is the use of the algorithms in the child welfare process. And how do you see this field continuing to evolve in the coming years?
I think it's really the future and the way to go, because, you know, workers being able to get information to help them to do their work, us to drive our planning and identify needs and do the analytic work to help people in a more strategic way. So we've expanded it. It's now people at risk at homeless. We have an analytic tool on that. And we've started Hello Baby, which is, kind of looking at people at birth and trying to do outreach that's not involved in child protection at all, but it's community, to try to give people supports and offer supports before they end up having any needs to get into a formal system and to helping everybody kind of universally.
Mark Cherna retires next month as director of Allegheny County's Department of Human Services. He spoke with 90.5 WESA's Kate Giamarisi. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Lara Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.